I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
Leinster could offer me $5 million a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Johnny Moe!
Rugby Weekly.
Little reverse pass, and
magic!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Wednesday's Rugby Weekly Extra podcast. We are rolling towards the big one between Leinster and La Rochelle at the Aviva Stadium. The Aviva is rolling towards a sellout based on ticket sales so far. It has the feeling of an epochal game between these two great rivals. And I'm joined, firstly, by Murray Kinsella of the 42 to look ahead to it. Murray, how are you getting on?
Très bien. Ça va, Gav?
We're delighted as well to be joined by a brilliant French journalist who's on the beat with La Rochelle on the weekly. He was down in Cape Town as well. Benjamin Judon joins us. Benjamin, bonjour, ça va?
Bonjour, merci beaucoup, and thank for the introduction.
You're more than welcome. Benjamin and I were just on a call with La Rochelle. They did a Zoom press conference, and I didn't pick up too much of the French, Benjamin, so maybe you can update our listeners as to what the latest was in terms of injuries to begin with.
Yeah, Donnacha Ryan was quite okay with the injuries. He told us that several players were hurt against Stormers, like Brice Dulin or Jonathan Danty, but he told us that they're okay. It was only a shock on the legs, so they could train perfectly normally on the Tuesday, and it's the same for Teddy Thomas, who was injured 2 days before the game. He has an alert on the leg too, and they doesn't take any risk with him, but he's okay for the shock.
Ben, it's wonderful. It's wonderful to see you. I have to say, it's better to be speaking in English for me, because you have to listen to me in French, butchering French a lot. So it's good to be chatting in English. I know you were in Cape Town as well, and that is a big trip. It's obviously positive around the injuries, it sounds like. But how did that trip go for you and for the team? And how big an ask is it to come back to Europe and play a big game so soon?
It's a long trip. I could tell this because it's 30 hours of transition, not only the plane, of course, but the waiting at the airport, several airports. For me, it was quite difficult because I have to go through Dubai before coming back to Paris. For the Rochelais, it was quite calmer because they made Cape Town, Johannesburg, Paris, and then they went to Beauvais to take a plane to go to Cork. So it was quite long for them too, but they travel in business class, so it's not totally the same for them than for me. And for the staff is traveling in economy class too, so for them it was quite longer too, I can imagine. It's not a good thing ecologically, economically. It's quite difficult, but for La Rochelle, this trip is quite important because since the beginning of the start of the season, they couldn't be together all the group, you know, because there was the World Cup. Gregory Aldrit, after the World Cup, made a cut with 2.5 months. So it's the first time since the start of the season they are all together, except important injured players like Reda Wardi, Pierre Bourgarit. We've got Georges-Henri Colombre-Hazel and Thierry Paiva too. But for the other one, it's like a new season, not in terms of results, but in terms of cohesion. It's a very important period of the season, in my opinion.
As I say, Mur, when we were listening to the French answers, the only words that I was able to pick up were Cork and très bien, which makes sense. But it was interesting. I asked Donnacha, obviously, about how they're getting on here and the purpose behind coming to Cork for the week. And like, he made the point that, as you'd expect, they've been made to feel unbelievably welcome. Like when they were going through the airport, they didn't have to hand in their passports. I'm not sure if he should have divulged that information, to be totally honest. And I'm not sure if I should be relaying it on a podcast. But basically, there was that immediate familiarity as Rog walked through And they've obviously had a nice time in Fota. They were in Temple Hill on Tuesday, training up at Cork Conn's ground, where they were greeted by Donal Lenihan, Brian Hickey, and a sign as well, relaying that famous Raj message about l'opportunité, which was probably a nice touch from his home club. And equally, the staff went out for dinner last night and bumped into the Lord Mayor of Cork, who was with some kind of a French ambassador or French dignitary. And he came over to their table and stressed to La Rochelle's staff that Raj actually has the freedom of Cork, which I think they were quite impressed with as well. So I think they've been having a pretty good time in what is obviously very difficult circumstances with all of that travel and just the amount of time that Ben has outlined there. And like, just to put that into context a little bit, Donica Ryan was saying they wanted to go to see an Aaron's Own match, hurling match last night, and bring some of the French lads along. But because they were just jet lagged, tired, they had to push their training back at Conn and into the evening. Like, they just needed the players to have that extra few hours rest. So they missed that hurling match, which was a pity, but I'm sure they'll be strolling around Cork today. He made the point that a few of those players will try and catch up with Munster players who they know and who they've played against. You can imagine the likes of Jack Noel, for example, being friendly with some of those Munster guys, I'd imagine. So
yeah,
and Alton Delan, obviously.
You had Simon Zeebo having dinner with Delan and Johan Tanga from Racing last night as well. It's a really interesting way to do the week, and I think it makes a lot of sense when you both outline it like that, the travel and also the fact that they're just going to be together in camp getting ready for the latest chapter. Ben, I'm curious what you have made of this season, and you're right, it is kind of distinct now, this portion of the season, but how have La Rochelle been playing? Are they the same force that they have been?
No, not well, I'm afraid. We could summary this season with the four last games of La Rochelle. They only played 20 minutes, 15 a game. It could be sufficient to win against Stormers, because they played only 20 minutes, and everybody spoke about a miracle that I disagree, because Antoine Astoy too missed a kick, a conversion, 5 minutes or 6 minutes before Manny Libok. So the season of La Rochelle, it's difficult because with the World Cup, the Six Nations, as I said, they never had the whole group to work, and so that's the first point. It's the first time. You could imagine Will Skelton and Greg Aldrit are very acute player for La Rochelle, and they only played 5 games together this season. Wow. They won. La Rochelle won the 5, so and the 3 only away victory was with those 2 players. So it's an important thing, but it's not the only explanation, because La Rochelle has is struggling with their mind this season, because we've got the feeling that sometimes they think that it's easy. Okay, we only have to play and we're gonna win. Maybe it's the back-to-back champions that provokes this. I don't know, but this time they are less underdogs than the previous seasons, and whereas they say that okay, we understand the lessons, we take the lessons and we could apply them. Few games during the season, we recognize the same mistakes, the same mindset, which too easy to I can't explain good in English, but they don't have the same strength. But it's a group that knows how to win and who recognize the big games. And they know that in top 14, they're not in the best situation. They know that Leinster in Aviva, it's a huge challenge for them. And they do enjoy this kind of challenges. They really do. And they know that there are some criticals, and they want to show Europe and France how strong they are. So I think this is an important point, a key point for this season, this game.
And it's not the first time that Leinster have been favourites, Ben, but it's the first time that Leinster have been favourites by a significant margin in this rivalry. Do you get the sense in La Rochelle or from the players, from the staff, that that idea of being underdogs could be invigorating going into this game?
Yeah, it's the first time they were underdogs and they told us, okay, we're underdogs, no problem. The second time in Marseille for the first final, they told us they were underdogs, but we could feel that they weren't that was not important for them. The third time in Aviva, they know that they could be underdogs because of the context of the stadium, of the Irish crowd, but Ronan O'Gara doesn't care about who is favorite or who is the underdog. He doesn't care. So his player start to understand his mindset, and they are telling the same thing than him. And in December, I think they were quite favorites, except the fact that Gregory Aldrich wasn't there, but they are Leinster as his the players weren't there too. So I don't know. This time they know that they are underdogs because they are not playing well. They weren't very impressive the last months. So I don't know if they think they're underdogs, but they know that the challenge is huge. But not only because of the Leinster forces, but especially because of them. I don't know if I'm clear, but that's the feeling I have.
Absolutely. It's an interesting dynamic this season. And it's such a familiar La Rochelle team now because they've played so much in the last few seasons in such big games. There are a few different pieces, though, Ben. Obviously, as you mentioned, Pierre Bourgarie, he's going to be missing at hooker, and he's been really important for them.
Yeah.
The line-out's been really good against Leinster. But how has Tolu Latu been? How has Conquiere in the back row? And I saw Jack Noel is a guy we know very well here, but a new element in this team. How have they blended into it?
Tolu Latu has arrived in January or February. January, I think. He made a perfectly start. He was very good. He had a very harsh game in Bayonne, actually, where he lost a lot of lineouts, and it was quite difficult for him. But the Rog and his staff management was very good because he starts the next game. He went in front of the press just before. And he has felt the confidence, the staff's confidence. So he is very good actually. He probably will start whereas Quentin Lespioc, the other hooker, is a good one. But Tolu Latu is in front of him. I'm sure because he started against Thomas, so he's a good player, a very good player. But Pierre Bourgarit is insane when he's on the pitch. The back row, it's a very very powerful key of La Rochelle because you've got Grégory Aldrit, Levani Botia, who are. Some of best players in the world. You've got Paul Boudon, who is now international, French international, but he was on the bench against Stormers because Judicaël Concorrier, who arrived from Clermont, is a very good, very, very good player. He only missed one game since he arrived. That is a performance because there are a lot of games in top 14 and he plays the Champions Cup one. Johan Tanga, who is international, played several games at center because there is no place for him in the back row. And you've got a young lad, Oscar Gigou, who is under 20 world champion, who is very good too, and is not on the group. So it's insane the strength of La Rochelle in back row. So it will be one of the There are a lot of keys against Leinster, but back row will be very important. And they know they have a big opposition in front of them. And Jack Noel, it's not a very highlight season for him, but he's already important in the group because when he arrived, he played outside center. He played several games with Exeter as a outside center, but it's not his best position. But he was good, really good actually. And he had several injuries, not big ones, but some calf, I think, and things like that. So he couldn't be on his top, and he coming back, but he got the concurrence like Dylan Leeds or Teddy Thomas, who is doing a really good season. He played against Stormers. He wasn't on the group. He wasn't on the group, but Teddy Thomas has injured, so he played, and he played very well. He was one of the best Rochelais, and no doubt about it, he was the best back, because the other one weren't very good. So he's an he became an important player, and it's not a coincidence if he has already resigned. I'm not sure the world is good, but he has an extension of contract while he had again 1 more year, and he extended his contract until 2027. So he's an important lad.
I'm very curious, Ben, as to how Ronan O'Gara is received in La Rochelle, the degree to which he is seen as a hero in La Rochelle, the way he might be in Cork, because certainly in Cork, even if you don't follow rugby, or even if you actively hate rugby, I think people would have a lot of respect for O'Gara as a player, as a coach, but equally just as a personality. Has he won over the people of La Rochelle with 2 European Cups?
In France, it's different. The coaches doesn't have any statues. A very strong. Sorry, the people love them, of course, but the heroes are the players. And Ronan O'Gara, Marcel de Flandre, and the La Rochelle's fans know, of course, that is impressive, that he is fundamental on the back-to-back champions title of La Rochelle. But people doesn't see him like a living God, like it could be in Cork, I think. Even if his role is fundamental in the La Rochelle's wins. I don't know if I'm clear, but people respect him a lot. They do love him, because when several times when La Rochelle won a game and made his we call that the tour d'honneur, when they at the end of the game,
Lap of honor, yeah, in English, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. And he's often the crowd often shout his name, O'Gara, O'Gara, O'Gara. So there is a lot of respect, but is Levani Boccia or Gregory Aldrit or Winnie Antonio among him.
Of course. Outside of La Rochelle, then, it, by fans of other clubs in the Top 14, is he seen as an antagonistic kind of a figure, an antichrist?
Yeah, if we I'm sorry, if we refer on the critics on the social media, is an important figure, is an important character of Top 14, but he is not really loved outside, because he's got a very strong character. He tells what he think. That is new in France, because every coach is already always say, no, I wouldn't say anything about my rivals or about that club, and he doesn't care. if he has something to say, he says it's quite new in France. So a lot of people that are not La Rochelle's fans disagree with that. They think he's arrogant or is but he only say what he thinks. And he've got a rivalry with Hugo Mola, the Toulouse coach. So he's Cleveland. And that's cool for La Rochelle, who had always been seen like a good club, a nice club, who doesn't make any sparklers with the other clubs. And with Rog, it's new. La Rochelle knows its strength. And knows that it's annoying for the other clubs and other fans, and they do enjoy that. And that is really thanks to Rog. Before him, it wasn't the case.
We're seeing a bit this week, I think, again, and they're reveling in that. And he's box office, and he attracts so much attention, and that's good for the game. Ben, I'm curious how do you think this one is going to go?
I don't know, because with this very particular season, I haven't seen Leinster play a lot of game. Only La Rochelle won in December, so I couldn't figure how strong is Leinster this time. What I've seen in the previous game is that they are very hungry men in the rucks, the breakdown. That is new for me. They used to be very strong, but not as aggressive as I've seen in December. So I think it will be the same case. I've seen that their defense seem quite strong. And in the other way, La Rochelle's defense is strong too, but their attack isn't very good. So I think it will be hard. It will be harsh. And for La Rochelle, it's important because they know they don't play very well. They know the challenge is very huge, but they know that if they are losing, they will miss the opportunity to make history, because Rog put in La Rochelle's mind that he wants to create history and to win a third title in a row that only Toulon did, and he wants La Rochelle improve until Toulon's level. So I don't know. I think La Rochelle will be stronger than we have seen those last games, because they, as I said before, they do enjoy this kind of challenge. But I don't really know what's gonna happen. I couldn't figure what's gonna happen. It's the first time, because in Marseille I couldn't imagine what the scenario could be. In Aviva, I'm sorry to say, but I could imagine too. I was pretty confident about the La Rochelle's victory. This time, I don't know. I really don't know.
Benjamin Jeudon, merci beaucoup de nous avoir rejoint. On se verra.
Thank you very much.
On se verra à Dublin.
With pleasure. I'm sorry for my English. I hope it's understandable. But I heard several mistakes when I'm speaking, but sorry about that.
You did a great job, and looking forward to seeing you over on this side. A bientôt.
Thank you very much.
Really enjoyed that chat with Benjamin Murray. He's a searingly honest Frenchman.
He sure is, and it was good to hear him describe what I have felt about La Rochelle's season as well, and having watched a bit of their top 14 stuff, and that it has been quite patchy, more so than recent seasons. They're definitely a big game team, and we know that. And I do expect this occasion to bring out the best in them, but their body of work in the lead up to this game, in this specific season, hasn't been as impressive as previous campaigns, definitely.
We have a question here from Rory Gaffney, who has run the numbers to an unbelievable degree. And he says, the context of the question is this. The two teams have met four times in recent years. That's 320 minutes of gameplay. Across those 320 minutes of play, the score has been tied for 14 minutes, 4% of the time. La Rochelle have held a lead for 60 minutes, 19% of the time, and Leinster have held a lead for the remaining 246 minutes, which is 77% of the time. These numbers include the first game, the semi-final, the most decisive victory of any of the four, and one which most Leinster fans would remember as one they were clearly outplayed in. So with reference to the above, the question is it possible that the overall balance of play across the four encounters would suggest that Leinster should have won more, at least two, and likely three of the four, and that them only winning one is a total anomaly, likely to be corrected as things regress to the mean?
That's impressive, impressive work. Should they have won? No, is my answer to that. They didn't win, and though they led for like that really impressively long period, that doesn't matter at all because they lost the two finals, the ones that really mattered. The semi-final is a good distance in the past now, and I'm not dismissing it completely, but it feels like almost a different era. It was COVID-y. Leinster got pretty well beaten, I think, that day. The two finals are the ones I've really honed in on again. And, I mean, it is only 1 point margins in both. And that's what those numbers reiterate again, is that it's incredibly close to Leinster winning both games. But the 80 minutes is broken up into different pressure points. And in the end games of both Leinster, they didn't emerge as the winners of that specific period of the game. In both instances, La Rochelle, they were more composed and were able to seal the deal. So the numbers they point to a trend of Leinster being really good in long periods of the games, but really sport is a little bit irrational, and you can play brilliantly for 79 minutes even, but it might come down to the final minute of the game being the most important one. So yeah, they could have absolutely won both finals, but they didn't, and they'll have to improve on some of the stuff we're going to talk about now to do that this time. Because the pool game earlier this season, it was important. I felt it was a bit of a statement, but in my mind, it is still a pool game. There's not the same sheer, overwhelming, suffocating pressure of potentially losing a final. It's just not there. And though Leinster will feel like a lot of the stuff they did well that day can be repeated, and even they actually finished the game strongly, didn't they? They closed out with a big defensive set and knock over an extra 3 points. What's really relevant to this knockout tie, I think, is the two finals.
I've definitely found myself in situations after the two finals where I have wondered, has the analysis of Leinster's defeat become too forensic when you consider how close the games were? And I would say, if you were a Leinster fan, you could make the case that there are a lot of what-ifs, right? So at the end of the most recent final at the Aviva, like if Michael Ala-Alatoa doesn't get a red card, like it's a completely different game, right? And it's a really... it's a split second decision that he makes, and maybe 9 times out of 10 he doesn't make that decision, and there's a degree to which you could frame that as being unlucky. But a key word that you mentioned there is composure, and that was a guy, and he's a brilliant player and a brilliant professional, but it was a guy who just in that moment sort of played the occasion. It was like he was overly keen to make an impact and he went over the edge, and like that is part of being good or bad on a day ultimately, like just tiny things like that. They're not unlucky per se, they're the tiny fractions, the tiny percentages that can actually determine the outcome of a game. And La Rochelle, that's where they've had the edge to me, is just like that. I know we're blue in the face from saying it, but it is kind of that 1% ultimately that has decided it. People might make a case it's a few more percent as well in terms of their physicality, etc. We'll get into all of that. Where do you want to start in terms of where Leinster need to improve, to your mind, if they're going to get the job done in this quarterfinal?
Well, there's a whole lot of areas. I'm looking back at the Leicester game in that prism, I suppose, of what has happened with La Rochelle in the past, what has got to happen this weekend for them. And I suppose the obvious place to start is defensively, because Jacques Nienaber has come in and he's been tasked with improving that side of it. Key 3 tries for La Rochelle in both of the finals. And you look at last season, Dante scored through Gary Ringrose's missed tackle after Leinster have gone 17-0 up in 13 minutes. It's phenomenal watching that start again. 13 of the best minutes of rugby you'll ever see. But even then, La Rochelle weren't... they certainly didn't have their tails down or go into their shells. And Dante scores too easily through Ringrose. Ringrose would have felt. The next score, the second one, is a kind of... it is the power game from La Rochelle. 12 phase where the likes of Antonio get really good power into the carry. And Hastoy sends... Sotteni over just before half time, so they get back to 23-14, and that was a key blow. And then the I suppose the winning try was Georges-Henri Colomb, who batters over from close range after a series of pressure close to the Leinster try line, where they use Skelton really cleverly in the line out when Leinster aren't expecting that. So they'll definitely want to limit La Rochelle's ability to score tries. And I think even last weekend, we saw some of the ways in which teams have tried to attack them. Leicester chipped the ball in behind twice, and Leinster did a really good job of covering that. La Rochelle also looked for that space earlier on in the season in the pool stage. And actually, again, Leinster did a decent job of covering that. But you'd imagine that Hastoy and co, especially with Rog in charge, will again try and tease out those spaces when Leinster are rushing, when they're closing up on the edge. But I'm even falling into that trap again of focusing on what Leinster do on the edge with this defensive system. Yes, it is ultra aggressive, but really what Niamh Abbott tries to bring is more, it's closer to the ball, isn't it? It's how they, as Benjamin mentioned, how they attack the ball in the breakdown now, which has been so relentless, really, in terms of that tackle and the barge and making it really messy. They've got the jackal threats, and they've got to get a better balance of the power in that battle. I think La Rochelle's jackals have been more influential. I think their breakdown work has been more influential in this matchup in recent times. And the other bit, like, it's so basic, but it's collision winning. and that's what so much what the Springboks do is based on. And I thought there were moments last weekend where Leinster didn't do that well, actually. The first try, if you look at the first try that Pollard finishes, I mean, Lowe exits, he doesn't find touch, but they get a chase upfield. Henshaw's offside for a penalty advantage straight away, which is a slip straight away. But then Van der Fleer just misses a tackle on James Cronin. It's a one-on-one that he slips off. And it goes without saying that can't happen against this La Rochelle team. A few phases later, Leicester are on the left-hand touchline, and Visa runs a really obvious direct line close to the ruck. But he wins a collision against Van der Fleer and Doris that, again, they'll have to win in this game. They don't get off the line. They sit and wait for him to come at them. He gets over the game line, and Leicester score on the next phase. And if you allow La Rochelle to get those carries, it's just a tidal wave. In Chasing Sun, they call it an avalanche. They mention it in terms of the French play when they have those narrow carries and they get on top of you, and there's no stopping it then. So that collision winning, that work close to the ruck, I think is so pivotal for Leinster. Yeah, they're going to try and shoot off the edges and get intercepts like you saw with Henshaw against Leicester. When they're down to 14 men, and if he doesn't get that ball, Leicester are scoring there. But you can see how they've been backed and encouraged to be so ultra decisive in closing up on the ball. Frawley nearly picked one off at the end off a scrum defence in their own 22. And that's the licence they've been given on the edge. So absolutely, they'll be looking to pressure La Rochelle in that way. But I think that work around the breakdown, Gav, is probably the key to what they'll be looking to bring defensively.
On the other side of the ball, Mer, where are the entry points for Leinster in this game? Where will be the opportunities to push La Rochelle to the pin of their collars and actually rack up points? Because the likelihood of you building a 17-0 lead again, particularly in such a short space of time, is almost nil, right? Like, La Rochelle won't be caught on the hop to the same degree this time. You'd imagine actually they'll put an enormous focus on the first quarter in order to avoid digging that hole from themselves, which you shouldn't do this because it's, you know, they're literally entirely separate sets of 80 minutes. But like, if you were to apply that to last year's final, it's a very different final. You know, like what I'm saying, I guess, in an awkward kind of a way is, you know, if you played last year's final and Leinster don't make that like explosive start, La Rochelle might win that game a little bit more comfortably. So like, Leinster are going to have to find points second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter. Where are their ways in this game?
Well, I think it would be great if Leinster could score high phase tries where they go through that flowing attack and they link out the back and there's really good decision making and they manage to just build that momentum. But it doesn't tend to be the case against this La Rochelle team. They seem to enjoy when the phases get higher defensively and they can put more and more pressure on you. So the two obvious bits are, firstly, what happened in last season's final to get 17-0 ahead was the set piece strikes that Andrew Goodman came up with. Like, he came out of that final. I know Leinster didn't, it wasn't a good day for them, but he came out of it with great credit because he came up with some brilliant plays. The 40 seconds in, Dan Sheehan scoring a try off a really stunning strike. It's a five-man line out on the right-hand side, no receiver, and Porter kind of holds Weenie Atonio at the front as a dummy pod moves towards the back. Conan drops out of the back of the line out and just comes in behind Porter. Lovely throw from Sheehan. and Conan's able to put him away on the right-hand side. Brilliant strike. Like, excellent planning, excellent execution. A few minutes later, they kick a 50-22 off another class play where they're on the left-hand side. It looks like they're going to play into midfield, but Gibson Park just pulls an almost vertical pass to Lowe, and they use his left boot to find the left-hand corner. The sixth-minute try is off a scrum attack. It's five phases, yeah, but it's planned and it's prepped. The 12th-minute try is off a line-out, and they nearly lose it at the tail, but they recover, and Gibson Park, if you remember, plays that kind of wonder pass out to the right-hand side. So I can't wait to see what Goodman has in store for this. And again, there was encouraging signs last weekend against Leicester in that regard. Look at Gibson Park's first try, the one where Joe McCarthy makes a break. That's a really cool and well-designed play where McCarthy has so much ground to make up with Sheehan coming all the way around the corner. There's a great angle from behind where you can see them going flat out. And there's not many second rows that can move like McCarthy. There's not many second rows who get used as that strike weapon on second phase. There's not many scrum halves who can delay that pass out the back to Sheehan as beautifully as Gibson Park does. So I think those elements are going to be like that's going to be essential to what Leinster do. There was a couple other cool plays in the Leicester game. Even the first Leicester game, I think there was one where they used McCarthy off a line out as well to strike on second phase. So it's going to be fun to see what Goodman has up his sleeve. He is very creative, and you can only imagine there's been some plays held back. And I suppose in terms of encouragement, the other bit, I think Birch mentioned this on Monday, is that Leinster seem to have that mindset about scoring very early when there's a transition of possession. And that's the case always. Like, the predominant majority of tries in rugby union are scored very early, first, second phase, when you've changed over possession or off set piece. But they do seem to have an increased attacking mindset in those kind of snap moments. Even the 71st minute try that Conan finishes is an example of that. There's a ball in the air, they win it back. Jenkins carries, Harry Byrne carries, and off the back of that, a lovely pass from Osborne tipping into Ryan Baird. Just getting into shape nicely and quickly and early and having that try scoring intent. So again, that's encouragement, but you are coming up against a defence who tends to adjust well on those transitions. And yeah, I'm sure they'll have their own plays up their sleeve as well. Like, O'Gara's clever around that kind of stuff as well. And they've got loads of weapons to strike with. So the battle of the playbooks, the set piece playbooks, is going to be really fun. And I've kind of mentioned Gibson Park there a couple of times, and he will, even looking back last season, the final and the start, he was so important to it. His decision making is just elite, and he invariably picks the right options when there's not a La Rochelle player hanging off the top of him or climbing over the rock on top of him.
I've been ridiculed in some quarters from my many haters for suggesting that Leinster have been kind of deliberately economical in their output in recent weeks and recent months. But like, the more I think about their season so far, the way they're playing, the more I genuinely think they have tailored their season towards beating La Rochelle. And that might seem almost insular or like too single-minded, but actually they should be confident that they would beat every other team in Europe at the moment. Bordeaux are a bit of a wild card that have emerged in the meantime, but like, they've hockeyed Toulouse both times they've met them in recent seasons. Toulouse, again, they might be a better team this season. We may well find that out, but it just feels like, exactly as you're saying, La Rochelle's phase defense, like the reality of facing a La Rochelle team, this La Rochelle team, is the higher number of phases you go through in your attack, the more likely that it is that Lavani Bhatia, Gregory Aldridge, somebody will pinch that ball. Like, they have an unbelievable jackal threat. You need to be economical against them. You need to score fast against them, like early in your phase play, if you are to be successful against them. And it's just like, the way Leinster are playing seems pointedly directed towards beating a team like La Rochelle. Am I talking out my arse there, or do you think like there has been a little bit more of a long-term approach to this game, even perhaps before they were drawn to play against each other?
Well, like, Leinster have adjusted based on what they haven't done well in those games. Like, most of the rest of their seasons in the last years have been excellent, and they've beaten everyone, as you say, but they haven't beaten La Rochelle. So they've tried to learn from that. And I think what Niamh Abber has brought in, it makes sense for this team to just shift that dial from being that team who's totally proud and obsessed with their phase play attack and all this intricate, I mean, I enjoy that stuff, but the intricate link passes and chains of passes to being one that seems to just take real pride in trying to mess things up now, just F it up for the opposition and be a more destructive side and yeah, score earlier as well probably. But I suppose like the seasons don't, are there, like, one of the things I like about Ireland these days is that they say whatever has happened up until now is kind of irrelevant. We just have to play well in this game and they have to do certain things well. One of the things Leinster have to do well is kick and exit well. Like for me, the losing of the final last season was their complete inability to get out of their half in the second half of the game. And I went back through it and it's so jarring to see now in the cold light of day. In the second half, and I'll list them off. This is just in the second half. Gibson Park kicks out in the full at one stage. Ross Byrne gets blocked down, kicking off a line out, straight off a line out, just inside their own half. Lowe smashes one out on the full after Gibson Park passes back into his 22. Lowe slices one badly into touch, so they're defending in their 22 again. There's a bad box kick from Gibson Park inside his own 10-metre. There's one where they're unlucky. They kick high into the La Rochelle 22, actually, and Jimmy O'Brien gets penalised for an aerial challenge. It was a very harsh penalty, and actually that... You're talking about fine margins. That was definitely one of them. But really, a lot of that was in... And La Rochelle are putting pressure on, of course. A lot of that was in Leinster's hands. And worryingly, for Leinster, they had a few like that last weekend. Again, similarly to Ireland, probably. There's a kick error from Lowe very early in the game where Pollard chips and they cover it. But Lowe kind of banana kicks one out on the full. And as I've mentioned a few times in the pod, I think his connection with kicks has been a bit inconsistent recently. Like when he nails it, he just absolutely hammers them, but it can be a little bit wilder at times. 5 minutes in, they miss touch, obviously, before the try. It looks like they're looking for the touchline. There's a poor exit on 11 minutes where Stewart gets great pressure onto Lowe. And again, he doesn't connect and the ball lands on the 35-metre. And Leinster are attacking straight away. So I think that'll be really prominent to their minds. Leinster, like, if you can just pick out one thing from last season's final, that's why Leinster lost the game, because they didn't kick out of their half well and they have to do it better. So again, like, I'm kind of going through every area of the game here, but that's the all-court pressure that La Rochelle put on you. And that applies to set piece too. Like, it's going to be such a monumental battle there. And it's one... The last two finals, La Rochelle have been 100% on their own throw. And that's why Bourgarit missing might be a miss. I don't know. Maybe Tolu Latu will bring that assurance. They were good last weekend against the Stormers at the line-out. But Leinster weren't good at the line-out against Tigers. 73%. And obviously a couple of wobbly ones on their own 5-metre line. The first one is in the fourth minute where Sheehan throws over the top of Baird at full stretch. They're really lucky to get away with that one. But they do then later botch the one in the 76th minute for the last Tigers try where it just... I'm not sure what happened exactly. They're all looking at each other, wondering what happened. Clearly, complete confusion between Keller and Baird and the call. But it goes without saying that they won't be able to get away with that. There was one lost at the tail. There was a botched lift on Baird coming forward at one stage where McCarthy and Healy seem to be right on top of him and they just seem to get that timing and that rhythm wrong. And that's definitely one area where, again, Ryan, his accuracy on set piece stuff is really excellent and that's something that will be probably missed. So I think Leinster have to nail that area of the game. They were really good in La Rochelle in the pool game, 92% return, and they got massive pressure onto La Rochelle, but they obviously won't be able to launch those strike plays if they don't nail their line out, and they won't be able to probably put a stop to what La Rochelle want to do if they can't compete better than they have in the previous finals. Like the La Rochelle Mall it's just so big, isn't it? When they get set well, and they'll again have been encouraged by what Tigers did. Mall tries, you can see them. The key is really not letting yourself be 5 metres out, but Leinster will have been... They'll have their pride a little bit dented by that Mall try concession early in the second half, because they actually stay down to try and deny the momentum in the Mall. It's McCarthy who looks to fight through, but he just gets bossed by Dan Cole. Again, if you can have a look at the highlights, just look at Dan Cole and his leading right arm and how he dominates that contest right at the front of the Mall. So then you're left with Baird and Maloney, who are lighter forwards. They're the kind of... They're at the heart of the Mall defence and they're not the biggest, bulkiest, heaviest guys. Porter and Furlong are on the kind of edges of the Mall and they're very upright. So all the momentum just heads towards Leinster's try line. I know Leinster, they won one back, didn't they, where they splintered the front. Or sorry, that was Leicester as well, where they broke another one. They splintered the front, and Conan just can't deny, I can't remember which Leicester forward, that bust through the front of the mall. So yeah, it'll be massive. And scrum as well. The size matters there as well. And it was tit for tat. That seems to be the case now with all these top level scrum battles now. Increasingly, you think it's going one way, and that was the case. 43 minutes penalty Tigers, where Cronin and Cole just dominate. They go forward, but early, what, maybe 10 minutes later, Healy is telling Dan Cole, enjoy your weekend off after they march Leicester backwards. So it tends to be tit for tat with most referees, and I can't imagine Carl Dixon will be too dissimilar there, but I don't know. I think the fact that La Rochelle are big and imposing in that regard, if they get an early win there, it could be a big into the game for them. So yeah, it's I've kind of gone through every single area of rugby, haven't I? Which I didn't intend to do, but that's just how widespread the contest is against La Rochelle.
Can I take you back to Lowe's exits? Because they intrigue me in a lot of ways. And this might sound insane. It'll be particularly insane, I'd imagine, to some of the coaches who listen to the podcast. But sometimes when I watch him kick a ball, I think he's just kicking it too hard. Like, if you've ever kicked a rugby ball at any kind of a rudimentary level, the sweetest kick you'll ever kick out of your hands is one you hit at about 90% power, and you'd be surprised by how far it would travel versus if you kick it at 100%. Like, when you look to absolutely thunder blast it into orbit the way Lowe often does, your chances of error increases by, like, I'd say 75%, just trying to get that extra inch out of it. And the thing with him is, he has such a long boot anyway, if he takes a couple of percent off it and just is... It's not like, I was going to say he's more careful. It's obviously not carelessness so much, but like, if he just dilutes it a tiny bit, he's able to kick the ball still further than most out halves. Like, I'd say Ross Byrne is a pretty big boot in him, but like, Lowe would probably outkick him at 90%. And that's where I'm like, again, it's a little bit, it's in relation to composure that you mentioned earlier, Mur, isn't it? But just like, it's going to be so important this time around. It was glaring in the last final. It's been a little bit of an issue with Lowe, just by chance, I would say. Probably you're only talking about like maybe three kicks against Leicester, a couple against England, but they've been costly. And like, you cannot do it this weekend. And I'd back him to get it right, to be fair, because he literally works on it week on week. I think he kicks every day. Like, he practices his kicking every day. It's not just this natural gift that he has that he, you know, unfurls from the holster every weekend. It's something he actively works on. So I'm just really interested to see how that goes.
And form come and go. Form comes and goes quite quickly in that regard. And when he strikes it with a pure strike, it's really beautiful. I mentioned that 50-22 in last season's final, and it was just a beauty where he's smooth with his action. And as you say, it's not trying to force every single inch out of the kick. It's being really technically good and quite controlled with it. That is hard when you've got guys absolutely herring down on you, as is increasingly the case. So I'm intrigued to see how Leinster set up. If Osborne plays, maybe use his left foot, use Byrne's kicking game, which is generally excellent, and Gibson Park as well, which is hugely improved. So it's about having that variety. The other thing is going to be so... I can't wait to see the team selection on both sides. We mentioned with Benjamin some of the newer faces there. He mentioned the back row depth, but Leinster's selection is going to be really telling. I think they're going to have a horses for courses selection here. And I think that's the right approach. You have to adjust to a degree for the opposition. You still want to have your own strengths on the pitch. And in that sense, I remember I think we actually did call the Will Connors thing the first time around, but I think it's going to happen again. I think I know that Leinster have been strongly considering it. He obviously hasn't played a whole lot since, and it's probably been frustrating, but his selection in La Rochelle was so justified. And I mentioned that collision winning, and he's a guy who just does that. He just denies the opposition momentum. He had some massive moments in La Rochelle where he just took the legs away from the big ball carriers, and I think that would be really important. I think they should go with a 6-2 bench because they need that impact in the last 10, 15 minutes. They need that ability to finish over the top. I think with Conan coming off the bench, maybe with Van der Fleer coming off the bench, you'll get that. we're not 100% certain on Gary Ringrose, but if he's not available, you have Frawley to give you that flexibility on the bench. If Osborne is in the team, you have major flexibility there as well. So I think they can cover all bases in that sense. But I think having six forwards on the bench would be really important. They didn't do it in the pool game. They had Natai on there on the bench as well as Frawley. And I think just to go with six forwards this time, to me, makes a lot of sense. I don't know what you reckon, Gav.
I have been thinking about Connor's prospective inclusion for a couple of days. I'm actually due to speak to him in a few days as well, but he hasn't given me any hints. But I really think I would really strongly consider that, yeah. He's like some kind of a character in a movie that you just, like, is it the bear Jew in Inglourious Basterds? You just kind of unleash him out of his cave. And he comes out and wreaks absolute havoc. And like, my only question to you is, in the event that Connor starts, and I would say there's a chance that happens, and again, that's genuinely not based on any conversation with him, do you go Baird 6, Connor 7, Conan 8, and Van der Fleer as a replacement?
That's what I'd be thinking. I think that balance worked well in that game in La Rochelle. I think you get a nice blend of skills there, including the bench, which is a really important thing to consider. The second row selection is obviously pivotal. I think Joe McCarty will start for his power game and his ability at tight head lock. And I'd almost be surprised if Maloney doesn't start now. James Ryan is going to be a huge miss because he's that line-out leader who's the loose head lock, but he brings that edge that is more reminiscent maybe of a kind of classic tight head lock. And Maloney doesn't have that impact in the collisions, but he runs a line-out usually pretty well. It wasn't perfect last weekend. And maybe that'll make Leo and Jacques Nienaber think, oh, we can maybe do without it. But that's not all just on the caller. That's other people missing the beat or missing the rhythm of the line-out. So, line-out is so important to any game of rugby. You have to have a really clever person running that, and Maloney as well. We know he brings other strengths. He's one of the best link passers out there, and he's certainly not completely underpowered in terms of the collisions, but I'll be intrigued on that side of it. I think the back row of Baird, Connors, Doris makes most sense to me. Just having Van der Fleer and Conan coming off the bench with that, the form of Conan, and you think, oh, he's playing well, he deserves to start, but his form is equally relevant punching off the bench and having a massive 30 minutes or whatever it is. And Van der Fleer the same. That worked really well again in La Rochelle, where he came on and was really key to them closing out the game. So we've seen the 6-2 obviously quite a bit, and we know Nienaber in particular is a big fan of it. La Rochelle probably go that way as well, and not that you want to pick completely based on them, but I mean, Will Connors is an amazing rugby player, so to get him in the mix, I'd almost be shocked if they don't do it.
Sorry, yeah, I think I said Baird, Connors, Conan. I meant Baird, Connors, Doris. And then, yeah, having Conan as that option as well. Look, we'll be looking into this game again later in the week when the teams are named. And I feel like we'll be having, like, again, sort of different conversations, because the complexion of the game, as we understand it from this vantage point, will have changed based on selection. At the moment, what's your gut instinct about this one?
My gut instinct is that La Rochelle will win. And that was my instinct at the start of the season as well. I think I picked them out as my Champions Cup winners because I feel that the strengths that have carried them to back-to-back titles are still there, even though the form might not be. I think the occasional will bring out the best in them. But I say it without massive conviction. I'm not lumping the house on it. It's been one-point margins. And you're so right what you said earlier on. Like, if they didn't manage to edge that one-point margin, but if Leinster had, all the talk about and all the review, a lot of what I've been saying here will be so different and slanted in a different way. So I think it'll be incredibly tight again, but I'm probably edging towards La Rochelle. Where are you at?
The more I think about it and the more people I talk to, the more I'm swinging in that direction as well, to be honest. And I think I said when we were chatting to Ben earlier, it's the first time Leinster have been significant favourites, and I'm just thinking that a lot of our Leinster listeners will have balked at that, and it might have angered them in the sense that it might have sounded like I'm trying to big up Leinster here. I mean, actually, in terms of the bookmakers' odds, they're 6-point favourites, or they were last time I checked.
It's gone out to 8 now. It's gone out to 8. I just checked.
It's gone out to 8.
That's big, isn't it?
Right. So, like, they are, as in, officially significant favourites. But I guess what I'm thinking of the way that final played out last year, and the fact that Leinster scores were actually pretty front-loaded in that game. So like, if you separate that from the rest of the game, the extent to which La Rochelle kind of controlled that game would have me a little bit spooked if I was wearing blue now this weekend. And also, like, one of the interesting angles coming into it, Murr, is Leinster haven't, like, in terms of the eye test, Leinster haven't blown anybody away really this season, apart from a couple of those games. So, like, the Bulls second half, you can say the La Rochelle pool game as well in January was a test passed. But we're, like, almost a little bit less certain about Leinster coming into this game. They haven't played as well as they were playing at this stage of last season.
But that didn't matter in the end, did it? Like,
really?
That, how they played in last two seasons, I mean, we were among those absolutely singing their praises through those two campaigns. And they did play brilliant rugby and they deserved the praise, but it just wasn't a factor when they got into a very different game in the final, which is going to be the case.
What if it was, though? What if it was? What if you're playing worse coming into this game and it just means you're actually a slightly worse team? Yeah. That would be my concern.
Yeah, absolutely. They don't think that. They definitely don't think that. I spoke to Leo Cullen at the very start of this season and asked him about that kind of theory of peaking and whether, like, you know, you can build a whole season around that. And, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but it was yes. that was something that he discussed with Jack Nienaber, who obviously has studied that in depth, and the Springboks do it better than anyone. But you're right, yeah, they haven't. Even last weekend, like, you can view that performance and think, wow, this is really worrying. I totally get that. And there are parts of it where you think, oh, they conceded too easily there, and oh, the tack didn't work there. Why are they conceding maul penalties and scrum penalties? But equally, there's bits in it where you think, oh, they've changed or are still in the process of changing how they play because they want to be better when they face a team like La Rochelle. So, yeah, the proof will be in the pudding. I like Benjamin's answer of how he thinks it's going to go. I don't know. And that was another bit of honesty.
Yeah, 100%. Do you want to chat about Munster for a few minutes, just about the actual game? We kind of got into bigger picture stuff on Monday. I think one of the interesting things anytime we put out a podcast is just gauging the opinions of people who listen to it and how, like, vastly different they can be about the same thing and the degree to which somebody might disagree with us or agree with us or whatever. And I guess, like, a lot of Munster fans felt that game in Northampton was one that, of course, they were going to lose because of their unbelievable injury list, because of the fact that those players were sick coming into the game. And then, I guess, you know, to hear us sort of, like, be critical of the performance, then it might be a tough listen because they feel as though there are so many caveats to it. One of the things I always think, though, is, like, what would a player say if you ask them? Like, if you ask Tyke Byrne, do you think you left that one behind you a little bit? Do you think there are aspects of that game that should have been better? Do you think you actually could have won that game? The answer would be yes, yes, yes. You know, like, every single player would have the mindset, like, we should have won that game. It's a 10-point margin in the end. You can make the case, absolutely, it was a 10-point game in the end. But for so long, it wasn't either, Murr, you know? And I appreciate that, say, in areas like the scrum, you might just be underpowered and there's not a great deal you can do about it. Of course, there's, like, scrum technique, but sometimes you just don't have the torque and that's it. But areas like the line-out disintegrated at such key junctures in that game where Munster actually would have had an entry point, a chance to tack on points in the second half, and it would have changed the complexion of everything. And that's, like, you cannot afford that. That is just, you know, it's just poor on the day, poor in the moment, right?
And that's totally how they view it from all that I've heard. Yeah, yes, of course, the circumstances were freakish. The injury list, unbelievably crippling, and the sickness made it so hard. And you hear more about the struggles of players. Apparently Gavin Coombs was just in bits by the time they took him off. They could see his GPS stuff just falling off a cliff. He was one of many who were really sick. But their overriding impression is that they still could have won that game. And the key thing is that they felt they should have been further in front. I think we did mention this on Monday. They felt they should have been further in front. They had to be further in front before the final quarter because, like, it didn't take a rocket science to realise, especially that they knew that they were ill, that it was going to fade off. And yeah, when I go back through the game, I see a series of missed opportunities. And of course, fans will think, oh, you might be giving them a hard time, but they'll be giving themselves a really hard time because they have to go and win a URC title now. This season is not over by any means. And they're going to South Africa. They're getting guys back from injury pretty quickly. I think Snyman's going to be on that tour. The likes of Daly, Nash, they're all really close. So they're going to get an influx of players back in the team. That'll be a big boost. And they feel like yes, we're disappointed with this, but we've got a massive prize potentially on offer. So I think they'll review the number of missed opportunities in the first half as being really key. We spoke about the initial 12, 13 minutes, which included a few of them on Monday, but there's a whole host more. You think of the 23rd minute where Zeebo puts on great aerial pressure on a brilliant diagonal bomb from Crowley to the left-hand side. The ball bobbles loose, Zeebo scoops it up, and that inside pass to Frisch. It's just over his head, but Frisch will feel he should have taken it. He has Nankivell on the inside even as well, if there is another defender sweeping in the backfield, and you score there and it's maybe a different story. The even leading up to half time, there's a few misses in the 22. Some brilliant play just after the half hour mark in the build up where Zeebo's really prominent, but then a tip in pass from Archer to Scanlon is just knocked on, that kind of basic error. Even the half finishes with Hodnett knocking on a burned tip pass. Stuff that's really in your control. And the other aspect of it is they definitely compounded the errors, and that's when they've had bad days, that's been the case. You look at a kind of series of mistakes that they make that give invitation, I guess, to Leicester. Look at the Freeman try. There's a scrum penalty against Lochman, then immediately Byrne is in the side of a maul entry. O'Mahony disrupts the lineup, but then Scanlon locks it on. That's a bit unlucky. But even on the try itself, there's loads there that they could have done better. And straight after, Crowley kicks out the restart on the full. So you've got this cluster of mistakes that champion sides don't have. And when Munster won their URC title and had that run, they didn't put together those clusters of mistakes. They definitely feel the tries were too easily scored by Northampton. And the attacking brilliance was there for all to see. Actually, I only really appreciated Northampton's quality of performance when I went back and went through it and saw all the little details. They absolutely nailed it. But I think Munster will be very frustrated, particularly the set piece tries where they concede on first phase from inside Saints half, the game killing score. It's a simple blocker play that you see so often, where 9 goes to 12 and 12 has 13 short with 10 out the back. Nankivell, who's also probably fading at that stage a little bit, just gets stuck on Freeman, who's the 13 at that stage. He's running the hard line off 12, and Nankivell completely bites down on him. So now Frisch is massively exposed as Smith does a brilliant job of turning the corner and straightening to fix him. Frisch has to bite on him. Zeebo doesn't adjust and bite onto Slightholm, who's coming off his blind wing. He's again probably fatiguing at that stage and he turns in late, but Slightholm is gone there. Similar-ish for the first half try, the Freeman score, which was just too easily got in the end. I think off a scrum, after a string of those errors, where Casey gets bumped by Graham, and then Odendahl does a really good job on Hodnett. He can't jackal the ball to slow it, and that means the retreating forwards can't get around the corner. But even still, Munster feel they had to adjust better. Life is made difficult because it's a really nice play from Northampton, where they have this kind of vertical stack of Smith and Laws, Smith and Freeman at the back. So it's hard for Frisch to make a read, but he does just bite too hard. He gets too narrow to Nankivell and he can't adjust, and Sean O'Brien has to follow him in, and Haley's taking last man. So they just got picked apart in those instances where they feel that their connection should have been better. So and I should say there's loads of really good stuff, particularly in the first half. Like, they played some really nice rugby, and yeah, absolutely the circumstances around injury and sickness were relevant, but so are the shortcomings they had in their game. And though they'll be encouraged by a lot of it going into this kind of end block now, there's definitely stuff there that they can improve on or cut out slightly, because they're still a good team here. You said it on Monday, they're still the URC champions, and with guys coming back, I think they can still put together a really convincing kind of end of season run. And the disappointment of that defeat is kind of going to start slowly shedding off, and they'll realise that there's lots to be positive about heading into this block.
100%. We, again, spoke about the kind of bigger picture on Monday, and I know it spooked some Munster fans who got onto me afterwards, just in terms of like the number of players leaving over the next few months versus the fewer number of players coming in at the moment. I know they're due to make two more signings, you reckon, Murr, based on a piece you wrote. Was that this morning or yesterday?
But so like, digging into that a bit, and sorry, go on.
No, sorry, yeah, like just you add Snyman, Kilcoyne, Adogbo, like a lot of these guys to that team for the end of this season, I mean, they're a better team than they showed at Franklin's Gardens. And like, there's cause for optimism, for absolute certainty. The weather should dry up for the most part over the next couple of months. That's where Munster will be at their best. And if they have close enough to a full complement, there'll be a handful for anybody they meet along the way. So there is still, I'd say it's actually going to be an exciting finish this season for Munster. And you can worry about next season when this one is finished. sorry, what were you going to say there about the signings?
Yeah, it does sound like there's a bit more movement. There's going to be a couple of signings, if Frisch goes, you'd imagine, in midfield. And Tom Farrell and Connacht is one of the guys who out of contract this summer and might be available. Definitely their hands are tied in terms of, like, they won't be able to go out and make big, high-profile signings. And then on the hooker and loose head things, which I had suggested was an area of need now on Monday, it sounds like they actually have their hands tied. They can't sign NIQ players there in those positions as things stand. Maybe next year, depending on contracting and that kind of stuff. So it doesn't sound like that will be happening right now. But yeah, there seems to be major enthusiasm in Munster about, they feel like this changeover again in the squad this summer is where they wanted to be, and that the renewal of the squad continues, and that core of players I mentioned, the mid-20s kind of guys on Monday have kind of taken ownership of it. And then the excitement about what's underneath it's very strong, I have to say. There's a great confidence within Munster that the pipeline is really starting to deliver now, and actually the next crop even again. I think you've mentioned this before, like, you've seen plenty of schools rugby. There seems to be real confidence that next layer is even better, but we know that can take a while to convert into senior rugby, never mind under 20s rugby. So yeah, there's probably more they can get out of the squad with a bit of luck on the injury front, but also continue to improve players, as was the case last season. Like, I called it wrong last season. I didn't think that squad was good enough to win a trophy. And I think I said that at the very start of last season. I thought several players in that squad had kind of reached their ceiling or plateaued maybe, but to be fair, they got more out of those guys, and they'll try and go and do that again, even in the next few weeks and on into next season.
Just in terms of their not being able to sign a loose head or a hooker, Murr, like, how does that work behind the scenes in terms of dialogue with the IRFU? Because I'm sure there would be people who would see Snyman leaving, an NIQ player leaving. Why can't they use that NIQ slot, per se, to bring in a loose head or a hooker? What is the distinction between those two positions as far as the IRFU see it? Why are they not allowed to do business there?
Well, a hooker, they have contracted Barron until 2026, and obviously the IRFU want him starting as many games as possible. He has been in a couple of Ireland squads, hasn't he? And I think he's one of the guys who really has improved in the last couple of seasons. Has been a candidate for captaincy and has done that job. And now Scanlon's contract till 2025. So you don't want to end up, the RFU probably don't want them to end up with a situation where they've three guys on decent deals there in the same position, but also blocking Barron's minutes probably at hooker. And similar-ish, I think, a loose head. Lockman has been, again, he was in the World Cup squad. I know it was via Healy getting injured, but they want him playing as many minutes as possible. And also, I guess, the spend, that's another factor as well. The thing with Snyman is it's so interesting because he's gone. You think, oh, there's a big block of the salary to come into play. But that's been the private investment from that 10-14 group. And it doesn't sound like that'll just be there for another player. That was kind of a specific project in itself. So, yeah, they don't have a huge scope either to be signing a big name there. But I think in a year or two, maybe it'll be different. And maybe when they make the case then to the RFU, it's different. And maybe they're more willing at that stage. So you kind of just keep going and asking and asking. And they did it with Tighthead for quite a while. There was loads of guys there were several guys they floated to the RFU, but were kind of knocked back. And eventually they got their man in Ollie Yeager, and he looks like he's going to be a really good addition.
He surely does. We'll park it there for the moment. Great to see you, Murr. Thanks for all that.
Yeah, thanks, Gav. Big weekend ahead. I have to say, I'm so excited about that game on Saturday in Dublin. And yeah, we'll chat about the Challenge Cup, I guess, on Friday when we've that team news as well. But it'll be a busy enough weekend. I know Munster will be licking the wounds still watching from home, but loads of good action ahead.
There really is. There really is. We will catch you all on Friday. In the meantime, mind yourselves. Take care.
But the boys in a better land. You're always talking about the boys in a better land. The boys in a better land. Time has come.